Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's edition of the Mad Tech Podcast. We're joined today in the studio by our very special guest, Sue Hunt of Ad Tech Programmatic Out of Home fame, I want to say.
Too kind.
I think that's quite suitable, don't you?
I'll run with that. Thank you.
Delighted to have you joining us here today, Sue. And we'll talk, obviously, in the second part of the podcast in a bit more detail about what you're up to at the moment. And, of course, our head of content over there in the corner, Lindsay Rowntree. How's it going there, Lindsay?
I'm really good. How are you, Rachel?
Yeah, very good, thank you.
Wonderful news.
Yes. We're we're having a little bit of a flutter in the office today, aren't we?
We're having a Cheltenham-based flutter.
Yes, yeah. Cheltenham Festival. Kieran's at the Cheltenham Festival. He likes to do this every year. Funnels through top tips, top horse racing tips via our group Telegram, our work Telegram group. Most of them.
Side note, they're rubbish.
I was about to say, most of them entirely useless.
Yeah.
But, you know, we give it a go anyway. Okay, so discussion of this week's news stories. Well, there's an awful lot of news about a very big story that we'll leave right to the end. Let's crack on with something a bit more explicitly about the world of ad tech and martech. And I'm kicking off with a story from TechCrunch earlier on in the week about the French DPA, CNIL, formally launching an investigation into Criteo. Now, this is sort of a combination of news and not news. Firstly, actually UK-based right to privacy charity called Privacy International launched a complaint against a number of organisations, ad tech companies and other technology companies included, across a few different regions late last year. And it was this investigation that has finally brought forward a formal specific investigation by the French DPA CNIL into Criteo's practices. Now, Criteo are saying this is nothing unusual as far as they're concerned. You know, they speak very frequently with the French DPA on all matters of adhering to GDPR legislation and handling data privacy. They feel very confident about their approach to data privacy. Privacy International, of course, feel very strongly, on the other hand, that this is Criteo is a prime example of ad tech companies who are misusing people's data and are flying in the face of government regulations and government controls. And they feel quite, I think, confident that CNIL are going to find that Criteo are not adhering to the legislation as they ought to properly. What do you think? Starting with you, Sue, are they going to find something? Is this just one in the long line of investigations?
Yeah, I mean, after the first investigation that went down in France with a fairly well-known company in the space, if anyone will, you feel they will. I think with this article and this story in particular, there's, I think, two main topics for me. The first one is I take a little bit of offence at how inflammatory some of the language is. You know, the ad tech ecosystem is based on vast privacy infringements. It's all highly dramatic. And yes, we know there are some bad players, but exploiting people's data on a daily basis, it is, I think, a little bit extreme.
Yep.
And I think for too long, ad technology and programmatic has been held in this position of being these really evil pariahs. Unfortunately, and I think we know this is one of the challenges that built up to GDPR, it became so big and so well known that then all the regulators get involved without truly understanding it. So I think this is a classic example of now where we're at, and Criteo very much, I feel to a degree, are being hung out to dry here. Where we look at some of the bigger players that we know are doing much more in terms of abusing data and taking advantage and finding the loopholes in the GDPR and the privacy policy regulations that have now come in, still appear to be getting away with it.
Yeah.
I think it's long not even been the urban myth, but we've long known that the likes of the Googles, the Amazons, the Facebooks have got more lawyers and more experts within their own organisation than any of the regulators have got put together country by country.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because I completely agree with you. The language that's set up in the complaint on behalf of Privacy International is, as you allude to, I think, deliberately inflammatory. You know, they're very strong about their allegations. They're using you know, phrases like deceptive consent banners and infesting mental health websites with targeted advertising, which is obviously designed to be very emotive. And they're clearly setting up their position that personalised advertising on the basis of data is evil and there is no two ways sort of around that. And it's interesting because you paint, you know, in your response there, so you paint a picture of sort of that quite extreme view on the one hand, and then how the industry as a collection of organisations is being targeted on the other hand. And it's quite interesting your point of view that Criteo is sort of taking the flak here, you know, when we know that there are other much larger companies who are probably operating in exactly the same way that Criteo are. So quite frankly, if Criteo are found to be in contravention of these laws, then, you'd imagine that the CNIL needs to start looking at some of these larger organisations with a bit more seriousness as well.
100%. And I think, unfortunately for Criteo, they've made themselves too obvious because they, you know, for many of us, half of our families don't really know what we do all day, and Criteo's ads are the best ways of explaining it.
Absolutely.
Because they are so obvious to the consumer and they feel as intrusive as it gets.
They've long been in the unfortunate position that when someone says, oh, do you work in the industry where those ads follow you around the internet? Yeah. And everyone in the industry goes, yeah, Criteo. Yeah. Like, unfortunately, they are synonymous with it. And that's, you know, that's a blessing and a curse for them in many ways. Yeah. It's worked for them. But also, it's not necessarily always down to them. It's down to the agencies and the advertisers they work with, the choices they make in terms of how they use tools like Criteo.
Absolutely. And they're not the only piece of technology in that chain between consumer and irritating ads that are, you know, that are not frequency capped. So,
yeah.
Lindsay, what's your point of view on this story?
Well, I think I agree with Sue to a large extent about Criteo, you know, being hung out to dry. I think they are in that unfortunate position where they will always be made to be a scapegoat because they're very well known. And the second that Google announced they were going to be introducing, you know, like denigrating a third-party cookie, obviously it was Criteo whose stock price absolutely tanked at the time. And there was an article, actually, I was digging around, kind of reading up about this in Ad Exchanger, I think last year, where the then CEO of Criteo said, I very much doubt that Google will enforce some kind of ITP style enforcement. It's not going to happen. And of course, months later is exactly what has happened. So I think they were quite confident they were going to be safe, particularly because they've been trying for a long time to try and get more revenue to try and reduce the amount they're relying on retargeting in their business. It's particularly the lower funnel retargeting, which is the lower funnel referring to, if it's been in my basket, it means it will now follow me around for the next 30 days. But they've been trying to boost their non-retargeting revenue, and they were hoping to get it up to 30% by last year. And it's only, I think last year, I don't know what the latest is, but it was like 19%. So they had a long way to go. Now they have to rely on that even more. And I think that this is the investigation by the CNIL is just a distraction for them, maybe, because they kind of have bigger things to be worrying about than investigations by DPAs. And this won't be the first time or the last time they get investigated. And they are a French company. So the way they get investigated, a massive French company, they're on the stock exchange, that might hold some sway in terms of how Criteo are investigated, because they are a very important company for the French economy, not just the ad tech economy, but the French economy. So that might stand something, I don't know. But I think they have other things to focus on. And kind of Privacy International, like Rachel, the quote you mentioned about this kind of infesting people's minds on mental health websites, again, that isn't necessarily down to Criteo. Mm. Like, it has something to do with it. If Criteo, maybe they should just kind of block those kinds of websites and entirely. But it's not down to them. It's down to, well, if I'm an advertiser or an agency, I'm choosing to run my ads on domains like that, or choosing to target via keywords like that. Or I'm choosing, or those ads are even allowed in the list in the first place. It's not just down to the tech, it's down to everyone that's using the tech. Mm. I think that often gets lost in these conversations. So I think Criteo, they talk a lot about their first party data, which I don't necessarily believe they have.
Dubious.
However, I think that they will be able to present a fairly good case to the CNIL to say, listen, we've got legs here. There's an argument to say that we don't need to be fined.
Yeah.
If they are fined, it could be arbitrary, maybe.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard to know exactly what will happen, because there's a bit of a maelstrom of kind of chaos going on at the moment, I would think, in some ad tech companies, preparing themselves for needing to be much more first party data, you know, reliant and operational, and then trying to sort of field these inquiries, which are gathering a little bit of pace off the back of how they're unfolding in other countries as well. You know, so this TechCrunch piece makes reference of what had happened over in Ireland with the Irish DPA having a very similar complaint brought forward again against a number of tech companies, not just ad tech companies. We know the ICO has done a very released a very detailed report into their findings concerning RTB, but it's and its sort of use and application of technology around the RTB piece. But it's interesting that we haven't really got anything concrete from any of those authorities yet. So some complaints have been upheld to some extent, but there's not been wide scale, massive fines put in place. The ICO have sent out a number of warnings to the ad tech industry saying that they're anticipating that they're going to be taking action, but we're still not seeing anything. And now, is this because this is just the machinations of the legal system that takes a while for these things to kind of be seen out, you know, be sort of borne out to fruition? Or is it also that you know, the industry is kind of cracking on with lots of other more pressing issues? And I mean, you know, further to your point there, Lindsay, about the position of Criteo and how the CEO was speaking about the company's kind of prospects, you don't blame them for saying that because it's a public company.
Yeah.
They're not going to want to, until the writing is on the wall, say, well, yeah, a big part of our business is actually relying on this,
yeah,
on this piece of technology that exists in an ecosystem.
They have shareholders to keep happy. Yeah.
So, you know, I'm finding it a bit difficult to work out exactly where this might go.
I think they are being very honest in their position with their position and their future prospects, and all credit to them, because they've had the big headlines of the CFO exiting, who took them public. Mm. They're announcing an expectation of a 10% year-on-year decline in revenue. On the flip side, as you say, they are seeing improvements in the diversification of their revenue. I think they were 5% quarter-on-quarter improving that number outside of the core business. Mm. But I see your point there, Rachel, on the overall challenges that ad tech are facing and how Criteo fits into that versus the impact that the regulations are truly having and the speed with which action can be taken. And I still bring this back, and I guess I feel like I'm being a proxy for Kieran here.
You'll be delighted with that.
Yeah. The bit that does really annoy me is these smaller companies are coming under fire, but the biggest culprits are the big three, as we know them.
Although Criteo isn't small, inverted terms.
It's not small, yeah, but it's nowhere near the scale of Google, not Amazon, Facebook, because it's also not a consumer brand.
Yeah, exactly. Mm.
And that I don't think they ever will be a consumer brand. They're starting, that dialogue is starting to come through in their aspirations, but I don't think they'll get there, mm, other than if people register that they were that brand behind the John Lewis ads. Mm. But I was reading an article the other day on Ring, the Amazon doorbell. Mm. And how many people even know that's Amazon owned?
I didn't after I owned it. I owned a Ring doorbell
and
didn't know at the time it was owned by Amazon.
Yeah. Mm. And that's now tracking when your doorbell gets rung and how often you look at the app and how often you use the camera. And you add that in with the retail data they have, Alexa usage in the household. They're now reaching into more and more areas of consumer life, getting their hands on the Premier League, the power of that organisation. But back to the point of the money they have to invest in their own lawyers and their own protection measures is frightening.
It's very true. I think in terms of your point, Rachel, about that, the timing, I mean, Privacy International put this forward in November 2018. So it's taken 15, 16 months for it to come forward. So I think that if we're looking at kind of what the actions the ICO are taking, it was only September that they spoke at ATS London last year. I think 2021 is probably when we start really seeing massive action from them, and probably other DPAs alongside it.
Yeah. And I mean, you're absolutely right. If you wanted to, you know, if we were having a conversation right now with Privacy International and asking them, you know, what they're hoping to achieve out of this, you would be wanting to give them a bit of friendly advice as to who else they could be going after in terms of pervasive use of personal data. I mean, if you really want to talk about, you know, taking over and controlling people's lives and infesting all of the websites that they spend their time on, you know, there are other players out there that have got a far sort of, you know, bigger role to play in that scenario. I mean, I feel like this sort of leads me into lots of different territories, which we'll come on to in further down the line with discussion of our next two news stories around the role that governments play in regulating the way industries run and operate, and the way, you know, publicly listed companies and commercial organisations operate, and then what the benefit is to the citizen, if you like. You know, in the world of advertising, we keep referring to them as the end user, but you know, ultimately, from the point of view of Privacy International, if you are a charity that's promoting the right to privacy, then you're thinking about the general sort of consumer, not consumer even, the general public, and you know, how do you choose what issues you really want to get involved in? And I think you're right, Sue. This does feel like it's a slightly easy target, if we're honest. You know, there's plenty of other ways, plenty of other routes that you could take this down. And actually, they're choosing instead to target a specific company because they're easy to identify, and because you know, quite possibly, the CNIL have got the effort, they've got the energy and the desire to pursue the complaint.
Yeah,
yeah,
it's low hanging fruit.
Mm. Yeah, totally. Okay, second news story of the week I wanted to chat through with the two of you is this one comes from Axios, who always do fantastic summaries of what's going on in the world of technology, not just advertising technology, but across a number of verticals. They wrote an article this week about the mobile video streaming service Quibi. Now, I'm just assuming that's how you pronounce it.
You're going long on the eye there. Quibi, I was thinking Quibi, like much more
Quibi. Quibi.
But it could be Quibi, could be Quibi. I mean, who knows?
Well, it's a good thing we're not the target audience, as Sue pointed out when
we absolutely are not.
I was somewhere between devastated and amused in realising that I am now at the top end of the target audience. Surveys are going to get miserable.
Oh, yeah.
Well, yeah, when you move into
a new box.
Yeah,
totally. Quibi, I think you're quite right there, Lindsay.
I don't know.
Quibi. I'm going to blame it on my Australian accent. Quibi are a video streaming service that's focusing on what I referred to in the office just earlier as short form content, until one of my younger colleagues said,
millennials.
Well, it's not quite short form. It's not TikTok. And I said, yeah, but it's sort of, you know, it's original content that's 10 to 15 minutes long. And he's like, yeah. And I'm like, is that not considered short anymore?
So we're now going, well, is this mid-form content? Content,
yeah.
Or is TikTok micro form content?
Yeah.
I mean,
very clear that we're not the demographic.
Yeah.
Anyway, original content of sort of somewhere between 10 to 15 minutes long. That's what the mobile streaming video streaming service is focusing on explicitly. They have sold out their first year of advertising revenue. So they haven't even launched, right? They're due to launch in April. They've sold out their first year of advertising at $150 million US dollars. So they've already raised $150 million US dollars in advertising revenue. They've sold this revenue as fixed agreements with a small number of companies. 10 companies, basically 10 advertisers. And what's interesting about this is not just the sort of potential business model, which is, you know, building up a kind of a buzz and an anticipation around the service before it launches, but also that it means that they're working on a very sort of project-based sort of relationship with their brands, working out how to insert those advertising opportunities. So they're actually six, 10 or 15 second long advertising slots within these short to medium length form pieces of content. So longer ads, I would say, than you would typically see in a regular streaming service. But anyway, I suppose it depends on what target.
But I guess much shorter than TV. So I guess it depends where they're going
for, shorter than TV,
right?
Yeah. But longer than you perhaps see in other video streaming services.
Yeah. I think that's the play, isn't it? Yeah. Shorter than TV and less minutes per hour than TV.
Exactly. Yeah.
Anyway, there's quite a bit of fuss around Quibi and the way they've set themselves up. I'm interested in this because of the way that they're working with these advertisers in a kind of exclusive project-based way. Of course, they're launching at a really interesting time when there's a hell of a lot of competition in any kind of streaming service, whether it's TV streaming or video streaming, and, you know, almost all in some form of a mobile device. How do you think Quibi are going to do? What do you think, you know, what is this going to do in terms of value for the advertisers? I also note that the 10 advertisers they're working with are people with really big budgets. Right, so these are not small, independent, but you know, what is this going to look like? What's your point of view?
A part of me thinks that 150 million, insane as it sounds, is relatively low risk because, as you say, they're advertisers with monumental budgets. So divide that out and it's relatively small for them in the grand scheme of things. And I also feel it's a little bit de-risked because they're almost exclusive by category. So if, you know, if they degenerate the relationship with Pepsi, they've still got Coca-Cola, they mess up Walmart, they've got Target.
Yes, because that's another really important point, that to start with, they've chosen 10 advertisers that are unique within their verticals, right? So only one, you know, sort of, you know, soft drink brand, only one, you know, global consumer brand like P&G.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. So and they're great categories that... Also, each of those brands, each of those organisations has a huge portfolio of brands underneath. So there will be a fit. It'd
be really varied in advertising. You're not seeing the same 10 brands the whole time.
Exactly. And there'll be
probably seeing hundreds.
For every programme, whatever that may be. And then you compare that to the overall budgets they've got. When they're spending over $1 billion in content, the advertising doesn't touch the sides. I almost 100%. Think their bigger risk is whether they can truly attract that demographic when they're going for the, I guess, the middle section, the 25 to 35, the much sought after. And it's that almost polarised gap of some phenomenal names with, I think it's NBC, Warner Brothers, BBC Studios as part of the investment portfolio, phenomenal CV across the execs that are launching this. But it feels to me that it jars against the audience that they want to attract. Also almost taking me back to how these lovely ideas fail once corporate suits get their hands on
mess
them.
Mess with them.
Yeah, MySpace into News Corp, Bebo into AOL. That's where I'm not sure the gamble will pay off, more so than the risk to the advertisers and the budgets.
Yeah, it's interesting. And also, as you rightly pointed out, the strategy here about sort of forward selling all of their advertising and creating this kind of sense of exclusivity amongst the brands they're working with and this big sort of buzz around when the service is going to be launched was all sort of a part of a strategy to try to attract a really high number of subscribers straight out of the gate.
Yeah.
You know, it's this sense of anticipation and this notion that because these brands are exclusive to them on the advertising platform that they're going to, I don't know, somehow play some sort of more pivotal role in the pushing and promotion of the service overall than they would if they've got their advertising sort of assets spread across a number of different platforms. But will it work is the question. And you're right. Anyone that's creating original content needs deep pockets. I've said this before, even when it comes to Netflix, I know that their original content series are extremely popular for good reasons, but geez, that's an expensive business.
It's huge.
Yeah, and they cost a shitload.
Yep.
Even their flagship, or as I think as they called them, their lighthouse programs and artists. I'm not even sure they fit the demographic. Yeah, it's why we were laughing at the demographic they're after. I'm a huge fan of J-Lo, but I'm not sure your average 25-year-old is.
Yeah.
Idris Elba.
Or 34-year-old. I'm holding my hands up here. Yes, 34-year-old.
And Lindsay, you are in the target demographic.
I am. Just, I'm just in it. Yeah. And I don't really get it. I'm not going to lie. I don't know what's going on.
Yeah. Okay. Well, and Lindsay, what's your wider point of view on this?
Well, I think that there's two angles. And I think that what Sue says about kind of allowing the corporates to kind of get involved with this is a really interesting point, because actually it's they're really smart. They're approaching the advertising aspect of this in a really smart way. Like, to be able to fill all their ad slots for a year before they even launch the service is quite incredible, really. And they're working with some, as we've just discussed, some amazing brands. They're massive brands with huge pockets. They probably, for them, this is probably test budget. They're happy to put test budget into something of this size. It's a new starter. They think, they like the concept. Suits getting together and having a chat going, I reckon the 25-year-olds are going to love this. They love J-Lo, I've heard. Yeah, no, I agree with you. Here's 100 million. There you go, no problem. And as we've said, they've got they've chosen really good brands within multiple verticals. They've got Google, they've got P&G, so they've got General Mills. So you'll have tons of different options around different brands that are going to be displayed. And the fact that they are encouraging them to be quite strict in how they create their ad formats, so the auto tilt of vertical to horizontal on your phone has to be done for the ads too. And there's a great like a gif on the Axios article of a General Mills one, which you're flipping the phone, the ad completely transforms in the process. So it's a really smart way of making the brand they work with. And it is, it's that's why it's so good to be able to go to these massive brands and say, work with us exclusively, rather than just opening up to anybody and then allowing any old ad format to appear on the site. It's the right way to do it. But I just don't know. First of all, there's going to be ad-funded side and a subscription model. I'm not sure who's going to pay for it. They say themselves, we imagine most of our users will go for the ad-funded model. So it's important we get it right. Yes, get it right. But how deep are your pockets? Because I feel like, Stu, as you said, 150 million versus how much this content will cost to create is literally a drop in the ocean for them. So I'm really interested because I don't know where this will fit. I really don't.
Which is another thing that went through my head of it's an obvious protectionist measure for some of the investors, for NBC, BBC, Warner, etc. And they've clearly decided who their target demographic is, but do they actually know their competitive set? And is it Netflix and Amazon, or is it YouTube? In which case, then back to giving power to the big G, if Google choose to use YouTube as one of their advertisers within their test budget.
Well, exactly. Which they are opening up perfectly the door. In their rights to do, because yeah. It's one of their brands that they're able to add at any point. And they're advertising their own streaming service, YouTube Red, or YouTube in general, on this streaming service. It doesn't really make... Yeah, it's cannibalization, really.
I feel like it's a bit of an experiment in, you know, building a streaming service that's got kind of high-end quality content like Netflix, but together with an ad-funded model, which Netflix hasn't done yet. And you know, we've lots of conversations about whether they will or not, and if they do, where they might do that. And I feel like it also feels like a bit of an experiment to see what's going to happen when another type of a streaming option sort of lands in the market. Because I tell you what, you know, if you're a US consumer, how much choice have you got around streaming? It is just never ending. And I don't know how you decide where to spend your money. And I also think that if you were on the lower end of that demographic around the 25 age bracket, you're definitely not subscribing to everything, I don't reckon. No matter how well you're doing, no matter how much money you've got in your pocket, you may be subscribing to a couple, but I wouldn't be surprised if it's very transactional, you know, if you do so for a couple of months and then let your subscription drop and then move on to something else. I just don't know how all of these options can hold people's attention for long enough for them to be truly loyal subscribers.
Which is another really good point, because I think this is only available on mobile.
Yes.
Yeah.
So hence it has to be short form. But then if you still engage more with TV, whether that be linear or on demand, it doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
Does this automatically lose out because that's the chosen engagement model, irrespective of the length of content?
And I don't know. I don't know what the answer to that is. And maybe in a world of 5G, it is also going to be an experiment into seeing how much our viewing habits change, because maybe that, you know, getting even all the more used to consuming on a mobile device, which I know has become pretty routine in Western, well, actually in Asian countries as well, very routine. The more sort of normal that becomes, I wonder if what happens is we just start consuming shorter content or have a desire to consume shorter content in that format because we're doing it while we're in a cafe waiting for our 9 a.m. meeting to turn up and we got in 10 minutes earlier, so we're just going to catch a quick episode of whatever. And maybe that will just become so much more broad-reaching than it already is, because I know that's how people consume stuff on their mobiles already, is catching up on the latest series of this or that or the other. But if you're just doing it in your commute or when you've got a spare 5 to 10 minutes, you're only grabbing 5 to 10 minutes of content, right? So maybe this is an experiment in, okay, well, let's design 5 to 10, a bit more longer, 10 to 15 minutes worth of content that is scripted to be like that and see if we get a higher level of engagement. I don't know.
Maybe. And they've got some big names they're working with on the content. They've got Steven Spielberg, Zac Efron, other people I've never heard of that other people probably would have done. But they're going hard. I think it's something like $1.1 billion on content they're spending, which is just ridiculous.
And they've also got some that they can probably get for free or on a transactional basis with their investors.
That's true.
I think NBC have already committed to provide the news.
Interesting.
It's going to be really interesting to see how this plays out, because it just feels like a bit of a different offering. And like you said, it's somewhat sort of a little contradictory, because we're not quite sure exactly what target market they're really going after, despite their having claimed this is the target market we're interested in. Does that market really display the characteristics that fit neatly with the proposition and the model? Watch and see is
well,
what I think.
And back to the first point, right, that we're not all qualified to comment anyway.
Absolutely not.
Lindsay, I'm afraid you're Lindsay. The only one qualified to comment.
Well, yeah, I'm qualified to comment, but I feel like I probably shouldn't be because I have no idea what's going on. So, yeah.
Well, look, and I felt quite certain that 10 minutes was short form content, and I've just learned today it's not. So there we go. Apparently it's even shorter than that. Apparently 10 minutes is mid form content. Okay, bringing us on to our third story of the week. Of course, we could not be having a news-related podcast in this week. What's the date tomorrow, today? I'm saying tomorrow because this is going to be
13th.
Published tomorrow.
Oh, tomorrow's Friday the 13th.
Oh, Friday the 13th.
Fantastic.
There we go. So, you know, we need to put
Doomsday.
A marker down. Thanks, Lindsay. We couldn't be having a podcast talking about news on Friday the 13th, 2020, without talking about the biggest news story of our times that's been dominating probably every waking moment of many people's lives and a lot of our attention, which is the coronavirus. Now, this particular story is a Business Insider story actually about the potential impact of the cancellation of the Olympics, if that were to happen, on advertising spend that's already been pre-booked and is anticipated to be contributing towards the Olympics. The article was specifically talking about and getting a perspective from advertisers as to what they would do if the Olympics was cancelled. Do they funnel that budget into other potential opportunities? Do they stick it against TV? Do they do other things with it? And there seems to be quite a feeling that actually advertisers would be looking to pocket that spend. Now, that's not that surprising, given that this current state of sort of global panic is certainly going hand in hand with a bit of an economic crisis for many businesses and organisations. And you can only imagine that advertisers are a bit scared about what they ought to be doing with their budgets and also about their businesses. Any opportunity to claw some of that back might mean that they just keep it held, you know, tightly held in their pockets. I think, you know, there's so many avenues that we could go down with this story because it just lends itself naturally to a discussion of where the advertising industry is going, what happens in advertising when big global crises unfold. How does the advertising industry behave? Have we ever seen a crisis that's this truly global before that's had such a speedy impact on business lives, which of course is always then has an immediate knock-on impact to the world of advertising and marketing. But I guess in the first instance, I'm particularly interested in views on, from the two of you, views on what would happen to the world of advertising if the Olympics gets cancelled. And then let's talk about the sort of impact of the coronavirus on the industry in a little bit more of a wider context. Kicking off with you, Sue.
I think at the moment we just don't know.
That is the response to everything that I just raised there. You're quite right.
Yeah, the thing I'm finding the most horrifying about this is the amount of coverage it's getting in every form of news, whether that be what we consider to be the more reputable news broadcasters such as the BBC versus the ones we know like to spread fear and drama and negativity.
Yep.
This is an absolute gift for them. And keep some perspective. 100%. It probably goes with the demographic thing of J-Lo and whatnot, but I have a slightly odd crush on Tom Bradby on ITV News. and he was presenting again last week and I was overjoyed to see him back on the 10 o'clock news, but also that they actually led with the Syrian refugee crisis.
Yes, because they're still
there. Because that's real. There's still a lot going
on. And real.
On.
And that's a really good point. It's real. This is the thing that's frightening me, is that this and everything we're just talking about, even this story connected to, what would be the impact on the advertising industry and marketers and brands' budgets if the Olympics were to be cancelled. It's a perfectly reasonable story to discuss and a story to kind of wonder about. But so far, this is all not quite real. You know, this is imagined, anticipated, not real at the moment.
We need, because we don't know what each day holds, we need contingency planning, of course. But it's how far are we taking that in terms of how much are we naysaying, how much are we kind of giving doomsday forecasts into what's going to happen in 5-6 months time, when arguably, if you look at how China's responded to coronavirus, arguably we will be in a much, much, much better position by then. Mm. We don't know what the next few months hold, so we have to try and stay as pragmatic as possible.
Ultimately, pragmatism, I think, is the key, as you've just said, Lindsay, but I feel like there's a bit of an absence of pragmatism in many corners of society at the moment, and across many corners of the world.
I think it's absence of logic, actually, largely.
But I think there's also been a huge amount, and it's somewhere between inertia and ineptitude. I'm slightly more leaning towards the ineptitude by government. And if governments aren't acting in the right way, how on earth is Joe Bloggs on the street?
How will their people? Yeah.
You think, you know, we're hearing that Iran are masking the numbers. Italy, I feel like they've just stayed in bed and pretended it's not happening. And now the whole country's in lockdown. I think our government is potentially being deceptive. Trump is being Trump. At least something stays consistent. And at top level, the reaction has been appalling. And we've suddenly now had, in the last 24 hours, the most insane amount of sanctions and actions coming into place, because they're now panicking.
Yeah.
Which may also mean, sorry, back to the original question, that may mean that if we're all taking this much more seriously for the next week or two, that by the time we get to the summer, we're in a calmer, more practical and more normal place.
I sincerely hope so. And I mean, that's a really good point, Sue, about government's response. And I note, just before we came in here onto the podcast, looking through my LinkedIn feed, I was really interested to see that the Prime Minister of Singapore had come out this evening in Singapore, in the Singapore media, to make an address to the nation. Now, I didn't get to see, I haven't gone into the detail of exactly what he said. I'll check that out later. But from a lot of my contacts in Singapore, they were saying that he put forward a very calm, measured sort of speech outlining exactly what the state of affairs were in Singapore at the moment, which the Singaporean media has been pretty sort of transparent about the whole way along anyway, and really instilled this message of, we need to calmly carry on with our lives, which I think, hooray, finally a government political leader is saying that, because I think that's what's happened. There is a vacuum of leadership going on here, and in a vacuum something else steps in, and what stepped in is quite a bit of panic and fuss and chaos, and you can't make sense of things in that type of environment. Let's talk about advertising,
this is affecting advertising massively. If you look at beyond budgets, there's how our industry is responding, and largely it's a lot of these companies have very strong, powerful legal teams. A lot of them are US-based. In the US, there's still a lot of uncertainty. So as a result of them having a lot of US-based legal teams, there is lockdown, there is shutdown for a lot of big companies. And we're seeing more and more added to that list every single day. Companies we're speaking to, suddenly meetings being rearranged because they have to go and work from home now, or we're having to meet them online. No problem with that at all. But you feel for the business development people in these companies, because they're still trying to go out and meet people face-to-face. They feel like they can't do deals without that face-to-face interaction. And that's becoming more and more challenging for them. So they've been told, I can think of many examples where they're told to go and work from home, but they're still having meetings in London because they need to get revenue for their company. And there's a lot of questions around the future of that. Obviously, other industries will be having the same problem, but it's interesting to see how people we're communicating with on a daily basis, how it's affecting them and their companies, and what the responses have been, largely down to you talk about sensationalism, largely down to kind of just like panic about, well, we're not sure what tomorrow holds, so let's just
hold off on everything.
Let's do the worst.
I've also heard some very, I guess we call them positive stories, because everything else has been so negative, that I think, and I hope I'm not misrepresenting, I believe the trade desk had an employee travel into London from an infected company and just said, please don't come to the office. Mm. No disrespect, no offence, but don't come to the office, don't take the risk. Mm. I think Facebook closed down because they did have an infected employee travelling in from, I think, Hong Kong or Singapore. They closed down the office just to give it a deep clean for the weekend, sent everyone home on Friday, said, we'll let you know whether to come back Monday or Tuesday. Quite a sensible response.
Mm. There's plenty of measures that could be put in place to just sort of, make sure that you're following sensible advice, which quite frankly is the sort of stuff that you ought to be doing every winter anyway. Yeah. I mean, not necessarily closing offices down, but
the revelation,
you know,
if we all washing your hands.
I was about to say, if we just all walked around, washing our hands a little bit better, avoided
listen to the UK Prime Minister, Boris Johnson.
Sing Happy Birthday twice.
That's how long you wash your hands for.
And I can't believe I've been saying that this week when we were in the pub the other night. And I went to the loo and came back, I said, sorry, I was gone so long. I had to sing Happy Birthday twice. Because you just want to make sure that you're doing it properly. But I mean, yeah.
I was going down into Never Eat Yellow Snow.
Yeah, there's plenty of things that can be done. I just think that it is important that there's a degree of our lives that need to continue and carry on. Now, I appreciate if the severe things happen, like all schools get closed, public transport gets shut down, things will be very different on a day-to-day basis. But until that's happening, we've got to crack on with things. And
I think it's going back to the actual story. We'd said this at the beginning.
We've not talked about at all, actually.
We haven't touched on it at all.
I think the advertising element and events getting cancelled is still very much speculation, but I don't think it necessarily means doom and gloom. Budgets can and will be reallocated.
Absolutely.
There's a very simple point that the Olympics don't land very perfectly on time zones for many countries, including the US.
Yeah.
So you're not necessarily even assuming peak audiences on the live events. There will be a natural distribution. I was reading the other day that through last year, I think 2019, certainly for the UK, if not other markets, was pretty bleak. I don't think anybody necessarily hit decline in terms of the advertising industry, but it wasn't particularly joyful. But a story behind that has only just come to light was that Unilever actually increased their spend, because again, for those big powerhouse marketers, there is always a product for every instance in life. Mm. And I think, I mean, it's particularly close to my heart, and hence I was thinking about it more today, having just returned from Liverpool and watching us tragically crash out the Champions League. We're facing the potential disaster that coronavirus may cause, the termination of major sporting championships, and having not won the league for 30 years, the chance when we've already got our mitts on a corner of the trophy, that the Premier League just gets stopped.
Fantastic. It would be a very sad day.
It would. You deserve to win it in spite of that. No, you don't.
But we're certainly already seeing, again, I feel like I probably witnessed the last European game for a while, and I almost wish we could have been postponed now. But if games go behind closed doors, rightly or wrongly, that will still bring opportunity. It will be a great commercial opportunity for all the bars and pubs that have had a pretty awful few years. The likes of Sky, BT, the big broadcasters will find some opportunity. So there is always some upside, whether we see that as positive or not, I don't know.
Yeah, and I think that's a good point. I think from a brand point of view, you're right. There's always places to put your money, right? And you can understand that if the Olympics were cancelled, brands thinking, yeah, I'm just going to hold on to this for a bit and have a think about where to put it. Plenty of other areas to put it into. You know, I was reading an article, again, before we came in to record the podcast, about how there's been already a bit of an uptick in people gaming. So a gaming environment is potentially an area where advertisers might flock to, knowing
especially
that
if it's self-quarantined.
Exactly. Yeah. And the gaming companies are doing great guns.
Exactly. An article that was written by one of our writers on our sister publication, The Gaming Economy, talked about that a little while ago with respect to the lockdown that was occurring in Chinese cities meant that there was an increase in the numbers of people gaming. So, but you know, life will still go on and people will be doing things and advertisers will want to get in front of those people in some way, shape or form.
Well, TV could have a bumper increase, linear TV.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, a friend of mine writes the sort of musical score for film and television, and he's just finished, together with the production company, released a TV series that they'd worked on in Berlin on Netflix. It's just being released. And he sent it to all of us, and he's always said, oh, yeah, look, it's not just between us. And now I'm telling everyone on the podcast, it's not that great. But, you know, I did the music, and you're my friend, so you've got to watch it. But he said, actually, it's really fortuitous because they're releasing it at a time where they're just expecting so many more people to be wanting to catch television that they're expecting a much higher audience than they ordinarily would. So, yeah, you know, people will just be doing other stuff. And people will also still be doing a lot of the same stuff. So we've already talked about how pubs are still full. You know, what, the rugby was on last weekend. Twickenham Stadium was packed to bursting. Life will go on.
And I think actually it's back to a point you touched on earlier, Lindsay, that I don't think we've seen some of the other organisations flex their muscles yet. Are the IOC seriously going to sit back and go, don't worry, cancel?
Okay, so moving on to the second part of the podcast, which is a bit more of a focus on you, Sue, and what you're up to at the moment. We know you're freelancing and it sounds like you're working on a range of really interesting projects. Some are specifically related to the world of advertising and marketing and some not. So tell us more.
Yeah, I think I might start with the not.
Yeah, please do it.
Which is something I started doing a year and a half ago as a volunteer, and now we're actually working for the organisation, and it still resonates for me over the last couple of weeks, is working on the National Domestic Abuse Helpline. There's the Harvey Weinstein, which again...
Has been sentenced,
which kind of got buried in the news because we're all too busy talking about the damn coronavirus. Yeah. And one of the stories that really resonated for me and also overlaps was Caroline Flack. Mm. And the simple be kind mentality that came from it. And you think two things with her are back to the irresponsible behaviour of our UK media. And I think us more than many other countries in the world that absolutely contributed to her mental health issues and her death.
Yeah.
But specifically around women's issues, she was, for me, I did many rants on this before Christmas, way before she died, that disproportionately vilified for the press for being an alleged perpetrator of domestic abuse, where the vast majority of perpetrators tend not to be female.
Yeah. And for our non-UK listeners that have no idea who Caroline Flack is, she was the presenter of Love Island. And if you've not heard Love Island, then... Go find out what it is, because I can't bother to explain it. But she tragically committed suicide recently after a situation with her boyfriend at the time she was arrested for domestic abuse, and the press went for her. And Twitter trolls, social media trolls went for her, as you say. So she was so vilified. Tragically committed suicide, and there's now a lot of backlash as to what caused that and what caused her to feel that was the only option for her.
Yeah. Mm. Heartbreaking.
Absolutely. And that's really interesting. It sounds like a really interesting organisation that you're working with. I bet there's lots of challenges that it's facing as a charitable organisation, right? Not least of which would be, you know, continued funding and support so that it can carry on delivering programmes and services to the people that it impacts. But I wonder, even just from a policy point of view, I think what's interesting about the Weinstein sentencing is that he got a much firmer sentence than was anticipated, right? Which feels like very much a positive thing. For all of the victims that were involved in that case, and everyone that brought a complaint against him, but also for this narrative around how things like rape and sexual abuse cases get heard and decided upon in a court environment. Of course, this is specific to the US court system, but it was quite interesting, wasn't it? That feels like quite a groundbreaking moment.
Massive. And whether he was made an example out of or not, I almost don't think matters when you know that was only the New York court case. Los Angeles have potentially still got to try and charge him.
Yeah.
And I think there was even the potential that he would be tried in the UK because there was enough evidence here, and because we don't have a statute of limitations, he could have been. Yep. So the 23 years out of the maximum, I think 25, is already massive, but still a bit of a drop in the ocean on the repercussions that could come elsewhere. I think his health will likely mean that they don't bother now.
Yeah.
It doesn't look like he's going to see Christmas, let alone 23 years.
Yeah, but no. Yeah.
But it's a groundbreaking case.
Yeah.
Whether it sends a message or not, I don't know. Yeah. I think it was rather unfortunate that some of the rhetoric from his legal team was, oh, it wouldn't have happened if it wasn't for hashtag Me Too. You know, like, you wouldn't have hashtag Me Too if it wasn't for him.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, I can't, you know, that's just yet another example of how something that is designed to be, in the first instance, kind of, you know, sort of kind and positive and something that's empowering to enable people that have been, you know, the victims of awful things to sort of somehow speak up and stand up for themselves, and somehow that just got completely flipped on its head and turned into some sort of alleged witch hunting campaign. You know, ultimately it was about empowerment. It wasn't about, you know, trial, judge and jury. It was simply about people, giving people a voice to speak out. So, yeah, but I mean, his legal team, you know, probably didn't have a lot of defense cards up their sleeves. So it's kind of not surprising that that's the sort of tactic that they chose in the end. It's good to see that that justice was done and that the sentencing was proportionately harsh, because yeah,
proportionate
it ought to
have been, is the word. We still believe that that. Or you're led to believe that that was still a very small percentage of the women that were affected by him that came forward.
Yeah, mm. Yeah. What else are you working on? That will keep you very busy by the sounds of things.
Yeah, I think that's actually quite an unplanned segue into the rest of the world, because in conjunction with International Women's Day, last Sunday, Refuge in Partnership, which is the charity that runs the helpline, in partnership with BBH, actually ran a huge brand awareness campaign for domestic abuse and for the helpline number. Massive contribution from Ocean Outdoor, who gave up the Piccadilly Circus billboard.
Great.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
Which does lead very neatly into emerging media and a new world coming through. And something I've been working on for a few years is out of home and its entrance into the wonderful world of automation and programmatic.
Yeah, yeah. Amazing. So you're doing some work in the industry on like an ad hoc or freelance basis?
Yeah, freelance basis, working on a couple of projects.
Yep. And, you know, we frequently talk about the opportunity in, what we a couple of years ago referred to as alternative channels. It's not really alternative channels anymore.
It's
they're
one
really
of the
quite
oldest.
Mainstream.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And the original
out of home,
channel.
Yeah, out of home is definitely a traditional channel, as it were. What's your feeling on, the sort of data-driven element of out of home, and where are we at, in that part of the industry, perhaps here in the UK and in Europe?
I think fair to say very early stages, and largely because the two worlds that are effectively coming together as out of home automates and puts more and more investment into digital, the data sets that exist in out of home are very, very different to what the digital world is used to, which is almost, I guess, back to the Criteo story, that the digital world needs to change in its expectations. And just because you can report on it and you can track it, it doesn't mean you should and you need to. So there is a big gap between the two medium at the moment, but it's not to say it's a good and a bad and a right and wrong, because the real power of out of home is a digital medium with a way higher brand impact and higher opportunity for creativity, but also much more specific and in some ways reliable targeting, because screens don't move, you know exactly where they are. Mm. And the power is in the messaging, in the sense of time of day, day parting, really, really simple concepts that, as a consumer, a consumer and a commuter, you're in a much different mindset when you're on the train on a Monday morning on your way into work than on Thursday night on your way home.
When we talk about programmatic more generally, we often talk about this split, this divorce between data and creativity and creative, and how one informs the other, and how when data comes into play, the creative gets lost and doesn't get thought about. Are we in danger of that happening to out of home now that it's becoming more data driven and it's becoming more focused on automation? Is the creative like could it get forgotten about and take the back seat versus the data driven aspect? Or is there a way they can work together?
I almost think it already hasn't been utilised well enough for it to take a back seat.
Interesting.
There's still more development that could be done. I think by nature of out of home, it will never be real time. It's not browser based. It's pretty complicated and in some ways quite old infrastructure. So by dint of not having that very reactive real-time element... Sorry, clicking my fingers on here is really annoying, isn't it?
I think that was sufficiently far away from the microphone. Yeah, no one would ever have been able to hear it.
It won't be subject to the pitfalls that digital has, I think, fallen to. Mm. And it's more that creativity needs to get in at the right moment to be pushed forward and really developed and thought about sensibly rather than becoming gimmicky.
Yeah. Interesting.
And to what extent, because we've talked quite a bit over the last year about the opportunity in these sorts of alternative channels that are actually traditional, that are becoming more digitized and perhaps more data oriented, the opportunity in those channels perhaps for challenger brands and emerging brands, smaller brands. Does that feel accessible to smaller brands with smaller budgets?
Yeah, I think it should do. It's a bit of a myth that, as is, has long been the same with TV, that out of home is incredibly expensive, just because it is so premium and so uncluttered. Mm. You're only, generally speaking, you've always got 100% standout on any given view. So I'm not sure there is such a barrier.
Mm.
It's more the accessibility of, you've still, I guess, to do programmatic, you've still got to afford your DSP.
Yeah.
You've still got to go through that process. Along with it.
Yeah.
It's, I think it's often as much that of, can you build the right partnership with a DSP so much as can you access the media?
Yeah.
And I think the real interest comes now, as they launched earlier in the year, is a player like Global, who have such a compelling cross-media opportunity, and truly being able to figure out your messaging, your user and consumer engagement with digital display, video, out of home, audio.
Yeah, because now DAX launched in that stable. They will now be have the capability of doing what we've been talking about for a long time, which is trying to marry those together. Yeah. And now that DAX is obviously, they announced a few weeks ago, a couple months ago, that they are, that out of home is going to be launching into DAX as well. That is a fascinating area to watch. Really is
so powerful, and I think it's also a really lovely story of the power. Some power starting to go back to those traditional media owners as we see them.
Mm.
Not to go back to banging on about the big three, but yep. I think a lot of media owners that we all know and love and still consume have lost their position in the market, both from their consumers and their users' perspective as much as from the advertising industry.
Mm.
So to see those players coming back and really putting a stake in the ground and being at the forefront, I think is incredibly exciting.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because I feel like this could well be, current sideline panicky global crises aside, I feel like this could well be really quite a good year for media owners and the sell side of the industry as they actually, stand to gain from this environment where first party relationships become really important. That means that the sort of, the entire sort of advertising chain is working a little bit differently. It means there's much more of a desire for advertisers to get a little bit closer to media owners to understand how targeting is working and operating. It feels like an opportunity, right, for that part of the industry.
You'd hope so. And I think that the really refreshing thing now is that we're starting to see some of these cooperatives, consortiums, whatever you want to call them, really pulling through. I think Ozone has been a fantastic example.
Forefront.
Of second that. Or third time lucky for some of the print organisations to get together, because they've spent so long at loggerheads with each other, that real old school mentality that the Mail and News are competitors, yet they're all working with Facebook and Google, who have got a phenomenal stranglehold on their advertising businesses. And you think, just reassess who your competitors are versus probably your best friends, not even your frenemies.
Absolutely, yeah. Really good point. We've run out of time, sadly.
We certainly have. That was a long one.
Yeah, it was.
Because you were ranting about coronavirus.
Sorry.
All of it. So it was the whole country.
Yeah, exactly. We're all saying what everyone else is thinking.
And you know what? Kieran wasn't here. Someone had to rant, you know.
It's very true.
Someone's got to pick up the ranting mantle. Thank you very much for joining us, Sue. It was great to hear what you're up
Thank
to.
You.
It was also really nice to hear about what you're doing that is not ad tech related. Because it's not often we get a chance
whole world
to talk
about
it. I know.
Exactly.
There's another world in my bubble.
That's amazing.
No, thank you for having me. It's been lovely.
It was delightful. And thank you very much, Lindsay.
Thank you, Rachel.
Thanks, Sound Guy. And that was this week's Mad Tech Podcast.